Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, February 19th, Joe was out and Sarah LaDuke hosted, and she was joined by Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, and Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan.
Speaking of the governor of New York State, another rather large problem on her plate this week, Governor Kathy Hochul mentioned on Tuesday that she may have to use the National Guard to ensure the safety of New York's prisons after wildcat strikes by corrections officers spread to more than half of the state's 42 penitentiaries. This coverage from the New York Times, but I know the New York Public News Network is also looking at it, covering it, and there will be updates. The threat was a response to labor actions that began on Monday, with officers assigned to two upstate prisons refusing to come to work to protest staff shortages and other conditions. By Tuesday, strikes had emerged at 25 prisons, state officials said. The officers union said it had not authorized the job actions, and Governor Hochul called them illegal and unlawful. She said she was considering forcing the officers back to work by invoking a state law that prohibits most public employees in New York State from going out on strike. Quote the governor, "We will not allow these individuals to jeopardize the safety of their colleagues, incarcerated people, and the residents of the communities surrounding our correctional facilities." The Times Union reported this month that the union had issued a vote of no confidence in the commissioner of the New York State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision, Daniel Marticello, in part because a reduction in the number of officers has forced the union's members to work overtime in increasingly dangerous conditions. Anger at the commissioner appears to have increased after he issued a memo to prison superintendents last week in which he said the department would have to get by with 70% of its typical workforce because of the persistent staff shortages. The striking officers, whose current three-year contract runs through March 26, refuses to accept the smaller force as permanent, and increasing its size is among their demands. Bob, would you like to start this one?
I actually think in this situation the governor should invoke the law. Public employees should not be allowed to go on strike, especially those that affect the health and well-being of our communities. Again, it gets back to the earlier conversation we were just having about the mayor, is that when you work in the public sector, you accept a different set of responsibilities than you do if you're working in the private sector. I will also say that a couple points. One is that I think the staffing levels in the prison system really need to be reviewed.
Yeah.
And that the workers in the correctional facilities and their families have the right to go to work in a safe environment as they possibly can. I also worry that, you know, in bringing the National Guard into the situation, these are folks that are not trained as correctional employees, and that is also a recipe for potential disaster. I will also say that this is going to be a long-term problem, because you just don't go take people off the street and say, come in and be a correctional officer. I mean, it's training. It's getting the pipeline in place is not going to be an insignificant problem, but it's something that I think the lawmakers in New York really need to prioritize. I mean, this is sort of fundamental in my mind to us being a just country, is that it's not just justice, but it's equity of delivery of justice for both the prisoners and the people that work in the correctional institutions. I will also argue that I like the governor. I think that we do have too many prisons in the state of New York, and we should be talking about consolidation. And I recognize that creates pain to places that this is a primary industry. But I think that also raises questions that we as New Yorkers should be conversations we should be having about. Do we really want our primary, businesses in some areas to be incarceration? And that's a very different conversation. So, to sort of sum up, I think the wildcat strikes are illegal. The governor should step in strongly here. and that this is not the way to achieve the policy gains or desires that the correctional officers are looking for. I also don't like the idea that this is also being used as a way of trying to draw attention to policy and law changes that they are unhappy with. That we didn't really talk about that, but there's also the use of different forms of incarceration like isolation that were changed in state law that the correctional officers don't like. That's not the way laws are written. That's not the way laws are made. So that's another issue. With that said, I would ask that the lawmakers actually talk to the experts before they go passing legislation that has some of these impacts. And I think there's been a divide. There's been a big gap between some of our prison reforms versus what's actually implementable and safe within the facilities.
We are discussing the wildcat strikes at correctional facilities in New York State and the governor's response. And as Bob mentioned before the break, another major point of contention, this is from the New York Times, is a state law that took effect in 2022 that strictly limits who can be placed in solitary confinement and for what reason and how long they can be kept there. When it was passed by the legislature, the law was hailed as a groundbreaking measure that would fundamentally change life for the people behind bars. But the officers' union has said that the restrictions endanger them and incarcerated people alike, and the strikers are demanding that law be reversed. So we want to add that to the conversation, as Bob intelligently did. Thank you, Bob. And look for first reactions from Mayor Sheehan.
Sure. Well, I think even the union understands that is not within the power of the people that they would be negotiating their contract with, that this is a law. And so there needs to be a process for addressing that. And I am a huge believer that you need to talk to the people who are doing these jobs and get an understanding of what they are actually experiencing day in and day out before you legislate. But don't get me started. As an executive, I'm often frustrated with my legislative branch and some of the things that they want to do. And I do push back on them. We have council members who, for all good and well intentions, propose legislation. And I will say to them, well, you're expecting the police department, for example, to enforce this. Have you spoken to the police chief? Have you spoken to the police union? Have you talked to officers about from a practical standpoint, what is this going to entail? So I think that's important. But I think very quickly, I just want to say that the reality of a 70% workforce, and I didn't read the letter, I don't know what was in the letter, but you cannot just create a prison guard tomorrow. You can't fill those positions tomorrow. And so we have the same issue with our police department, and it is so challenging. And the fact that we are inversing our officers, that they are working the hours that they are working, it is not acceptable to me. And so I think it's important for those of us in elected office and commissioners to acknowledge that and to say that this is not okay. It's not okay. And these are the steps that we're taking to try to address it. One of the things that we're doing with our police department is we're bringing somebody in to really look at the jobs that we're doing, because we have to reimagine the job. If we are not going to be able to recruit quality people, because we can't lower our standards, these jobs require people who have the ability to work under pressure, to de-escalate very dangerous situations, to put themselves in danger. These are jobs that require the right people. And so you can't lower the standards. And I don't think those who are on the job now would want us to lower the standards, whether it's prison guards or police officers. So what do we do to maximize the time that is spent doing those parts of the job and take things off of our officers' plates that maybe don't require somebody with that skill set and that level that can be done more administratively? And so we have to reimagine these jobs. And I think we have to reimagine the prison system. And, you know, many of the good points that were made, consolidating, looking for opportunities to think differently about the places and spaces and the amount of resource that is needed given the current footprint of the prison system in New York State. That has to be part of the conversation, because there's no cavalry. And, you know, we had 110 people take the police exam. We are now giving the police exam virtually every 4 months. Fortunately, thanks to the cooperation from the New York State Civil Service Commission, we are working to try to increase the number of applicants and the number of recruits that we're able to hire. But where we used to have 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 people taking the test, we now have 100, 120, 125. You might get 10 qualified officers out of that pool of test takers. And then of those, once they get into the academy, you're going to lose some of them. And so this is a real challenge, and we have to reimagine these jobs. And we as leaders have to talk to the people who are doing the jobs and figure out what we can do to address these very serious quality of life, safety issues that these corrections officers are talking about.
The state police said on Tuesday they are assisting the corrections department by providing outer perimeter security at some prisons where officers are striking. Jennifer Scaife is the executive director of the Correctional Association of New York, a state prison oversight group. She said that officers at prisons across the state had complained to the association of regularly having to work 16-hour shifts. Such schedules were unsustainable and a sign of crisis in the prison system, she said. But she also noted the strikers were demanding things that the governor could not provide unilaterally, as we've said. Prisoners' rights groups have criticized the strikes, and one accused strikers of trying to divert attention from the death of Mr. Brooks in an upstate New York prison recently. Heather.
So I have to say, I first strongly agree with everything that has been said so far. I think that the thing that, you know, to me is really sort of gut-wrenching is there are people who are incarcerated that the people who are supposed to be taking care of them are on strike. What, you know, this is really, really frightening and inhumane. And I mentioned on air a number of times, a former public defender. I think that we are a society that over incarcerates. I think incarceration should be an absolute last resort. I think it creates outcomes that put people in a place where as much as we like to talk about it as rehabilitative, it really isn't. We are not a society that tends to forgive, that
right.
tends to give second chances.
Recidivism rates indicate not a lot of rehab.
I mean, there's not a lot of opportunities for people once they've been incarcerated. I think that incarceration really should be a last resort to begin with. It is appalling to me that someone would think about leaving someone who is incarcerated, who cannot, they can't fend for themselves, they can't feed themselves, they don't. So I'm hopeful that someone is sent in to at least make sure that there's order maintained, that the food is, you know, sent in, that, you know, someone is keeping the lights on and keeping them
in the heat.
There is a very, very big problem with the system, and it's not just the inmates, and it's not just whether or not they can use solitary confinement, which it is a terrible last resort of last resorts, right? I mean, it has severe psychological consequences to the people who experience it. These are all factors, but we really need to reevaluate. Prison and incarceration an economic development tool for communities that are hollowed out because we have policies that drove manufacturing out of upstate New York communities? I mean, these are really big systemic policy issues. And at the core of all of it is a reluctance to listen, and Bob said this, to expertise, to people who will, with expertise, advise and guide policymakers. And we have really gone away from that. We are very much, you're either for the police or against the police. You're either for the environment or against the environment. And it's black or white. You're either on this side of the aisle or that side of the aisle. We really need to do a lot more conversing, a lot more thoughtful discussion about how we build policies around incarceration and listen to experts about what works and what doesn't work. Why are we having trouble recruiting police officers? I don't know. There's a huge part of society that says defund the police or doesn't like and then there's the great blue wall and there's dirt on everyone's hands. There's problems on both sides, but really there are underlying issues, societal issues that are behind all of this. But it is unacceptable to leave people who are not able to feed themselves, to take care of themselves, to leave them and use that as leverage in this society. That is not okay.
Bob?
I think, you know, there's a couple of interesting points that, you know, we can sort of go down any one of these rabbit holes. You know, one of the interesting points that sort of bubbled up is a discussion about the American workforce. Mm-hmm. And what happens when positions that we deem are critical to our society, people don't want to do that. What do we do as a society in order to promote, to fill sort of critical positions? And I know that gets into everything from economic development to taxation policy to, frankly, respect and, you know,
training and locations.
All of this is connected. Exactly.
Right.
I don't see anywhere the political will to have conversations. I hear people go after, oh, you know, the younger generations don't want to do this. You know, maybe they're smarter than we are. Maybe they're smarter than saying that, no, I'm not going to be a slave to a 60, 70 hour work week, or, you know, rather than saying the younger generation is lazy, we're saying that maybe we need to start to have an overall conversation about what our work weeks look like. But again, this is where you start to have a federal, you know, that should be a national conversation, which is really difficult. And I do hearken back to what's going on with the federal workforce right now, where the level of disrespect that the federal workforce is receiving is going to bite this country right in the keister. Because why anybody who's talented and cares about the country would go into service right now, when, you know, frankly, they're being fired in probationary periods. Excellent employees who have excellent reviews are being fired. Why would anybody want to do that? And it sort of raises the same question of why does anybody want to, you know, go into public service if it's it's a threat to your life. You don't feel like you're compensated. You don't feel like you're appreciated. But boy, there's a really important conversation about our collective future right now. And it does link back with immigration. It does link back with you know, who's going to do these jobs. And these just are really tough conversations. But there's a growing crisis in this country that we need to be aware of. You know, my mother was in the emergency room last night. She fell and she broke her wrist. My mom has dementia, so it's even more difficult. She was in the ER for 9 hours last night, okay? 7 before she saw a doctor. There aren't enough healthcare specialists to take care of us. What are we doing about it? Where's the conversation on it?
And I think that's where we have to demand more of leadership. And so when we think about reimagining prisons, well, we all know that there is a shocking number of people with serious mental illness in our prisons. That's where people with serious mental health issues often end up now. They don't end up in a hospital or in a facility to treat their mental illness. Well, we know that they're there. Maybe the 30% of the jobs that are missing are jobs of mental health professionals and providers who can assist people who have committed crimes. They've gone to prison, but they also have serious mental health issues. Imagine if we treated them. I mean, that would be a remarkable positive for prison guards, for the work that they're doing, for the others who are incarcerated and maybe incarcerated with somebody who has a very serious untreated mental health issue. And outcomes, you know, to Heather's point of what is it? Why are we incarcerating people and what do we want the outcome to be?
Right, yeah.
And so getting the help that you need. So these are the conversations and the seriousness with which we need to be approaching these challenges. And as our workforce ages, as we cut off the spigot with respect to immigration, and I'm a huge proponent, I want immigration to be done right. I don't want people with criminal records coming into my community. Nobody wants that. We want common sense immigration rules of the road that everybody knows and can follow. And so these are things that we need to be demanding. And I think instead we get into our bubbles and we politicize everything. And it makes it very difficult to do the work that needs to be done. I'm a huge believer. Let's roll up our sleeves and do this work. We can solve this. But we have to be willing to talk to one another. We have to be willing to take the politics out of it. We have to stop what we're doing now because it's not working and it's having real life consequences for people whose lives are now in danger.
That was Kathy Sheehan on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, February 19th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, February 20th, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, former New York 19th Congressman and New York Assemblyman John Faso, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, and investment banker on Wall Street Mark Whitman.
As the New York Times puts it, Trump flipping the script on the Ukraine war, blaming Zelensky, not Putin. I will read you from that article, and then we will break up into individual groups and discuss.
I'll just keep talking to myself.
When Russian forces crashed over the borders into Ukraine in 2022, determined to wipe it off the map as an independent state, the United States rushed to aid the beleaguered nation and cast its president, Volodymyr Zelensky, as a hero of resistance. 3 years almost to the day later, President Trump is rewriting the history of Russia's invasion of its smaller neighbor, Ukraine. In this version, is not a victim, but a villain. And Mr. Zelensky is not a latter-day Winston Churchill, but a dictator without elections who somehow started the war himself and conned America into helping. Mr. Trump's revisionism sets the stage for a geopolitical about-face unlike any in generations as the president embarks on negotiations with Russia that Ukraine fears could come at its own expense. By vilifying Mr. Zelensky and shifting blame for the war from Moscow to Kyiv, Mr. Trump seems to be laying a predicate for withdrawing support for an ally under attack. The sharp exchange of words between Mr. Trump and Zelensky this week signaled how much has changed with the inauguration of a new president in Washington. Even for Mr. Trump, who has never been a fan of Ukraine and has long expressed admiration of Vladimir Putin, the vitriol expressed toward Mr. Zelensky drew gasps of surprise on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. Mark?
Well, Joe, we should have seen this coming. If you remember back in Trump 1 when Putin and Trump met in Helsinki, and the topic of the day was, had the Russians tried to and interfered with U.S. elections? And almost everyone in the security apparatus in the United States was telling President Donald Trump that that had happened. Vladimir Putin said it had not happened. And if you remember, Vladimir Putin pulled off this amazing feat. I didn't know he knew how to speak English without an accent, but somehow, from across the room, he basically had Trump repeat the Russian talking points with respect to the issue of had Russia interfered in the U.S. election. His ventriloquist skills were amazing. Not even as good, by the way, as Tom Homan's are with the New York City mayor, but even better. So Trump is what is Trump laying the groundwork for? Well, Trump wants out of the war, and he wants to significantly reduce the U.S. military presence for and support of Europe. What's he doing? He's making Vladimir Zelensky the bad guy. He's a dictator. He started the war, which is an amazing proposition, by the way, to invade yourself. I'm not sure how that works, but that's the assertion. Why does he do that? Because he's going to sell Ukraine out. It's going to be a disaster. It will be either a husk of a state or potentially even a state with warring factions or battling itself under Russia's shadow, not a successful country any longer. And it will be Trump's responsibility. But if you start by blaming the whole affair on the Ukrainians themselves and the person of Vladimir Zelensky, you can somehow then take the political position that you didn't make a mistake in the negotiations and in selling out Ukraine. And by the way, when I say mistake, I mean the administration, if you look at their approach to negotiations, the number of rookie mistakes that they have already made is jaw-dropping. There's no way you should have the Secretary of State of the United States sitting across the table from his alleged counterpart while there are still hostilities going on. You should have held out for at least sort of a everybody stays in their bunker and low burn kind of a ceasefire. So, I mean, the number of errors that they've already made. And then what? Just one more thing. You know, Trump is going to jump up and down when Putin says, well, in order for us to get peace, you've got to lighten up your U.S. military presence in Europe. And Trump's going to come out of the room, or his representatives will, and say, you know, it was a hard concession, but we're going to give it to him because we want the dying to stop. This is nonsense. It's consistent with what Trump has done. Even his own advisors historically wondered aloud what the Russians have on him. I don't know whether they do or don't. It doesn't matter. He always acts as if they do. And that's how we should presume this is going to continue.
One thing I just have to ask you about and maybe point out is that when you say make mistakes, and I understand what you're saying, of course, because by history and by the rules that we've been operating under for hundreds of years, that's what you do. But obviously in every step, in almost every corner of this administration, things are different. And I think the whole point is either mistake or just to do things differently, right?
Well, when you say differently, Trump wants to come to a solution quickly. By the way, he's already failed utterly on his promise to the world, which was to get this war done before he was inaugurated. So no matter what he does, he's a failure on this topic. But he wants it done. He wants it done quickly. That's why he's trying to sideline the Ukrainians and the Europeans from the initial rounds of discussions. But in doing that, they've already given away more than they should have and not accomplished nearly as much as they should have in order to have the level of talks that they're already having with the Russians.
John.
Well, I completely disagree with what President Trump's comments yesterday. To compare Zelensky and say he's a dictator and compare him unfavorably to Putin, I think is just totally wrong. And it's frankly, I'm reminded of Neville Chamberlain going to Munich and thinking we were going to have peace in our time. I think that the president has approached this in every way in a bad fashion. I really think that he runs a great risk here of having the destruction of Ukraine and its fledgling democracy on his watch. And I think that will send a terrible signal to our adversaries around the world and our allies in Europe, et cetera. Now, the president is correct that the Europeans haven't done enough, that they are disorganized in terms of their response. They do not have a coherent unified position necessarily. Obviously, the Baltic states and Poland have been the strongest against what Putin has done, as has the UK. The French and the Germans, frankly, the Germans, you know, I'm reminded of what Churchill once said about the Germans. He said, they're either at your feet or at your throat. And they have vacillated tremendously. They had, you know.
We've said that about Libby.
I'm at, not af- I'm not never after, at his feet.
Not after her birthday.
No.
But, you know, the fact is that I think, you know, maybe this is some grand stratagem that the president has in mind, but I don't see it. And I think that this entire thing is shaping up as a fiasco. Comparing Zelensky and elections in Ukraine to non-elections and fake elections in Russia is absurd. So, I mean, on every count, the president's statements from when he, shortly after Putin invaded Ukraine, he said Putin was a genius. On every count, I think his statements and policy have been wrong. I would note that he gave weapons and Stinger missiles, et cetera, to Ukraine in 2017, 2018. I don't think he's in the pocket of Putin. I think he views this as simply another transactional situation. And people's lives and freedom and the question of democracy versus a totalitarian state, I don't think those can necessarily be transacted away.
Let me just ask a follow-up question, which, because I think I just want to fully understand, as I try to fully understand this, your very good point about while those in Europe have perhaps been somewhat disorganized in this matter, but was not the chance on Monday when they were all sitting down in Saudi Arabia discussing this, that would have been an opportunity to bring in European counterparts to have a discussion as opposed to keeping everybody else out?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to second guess that, because I think what they want, what the Trump administration, what the president wants to do is to get a better understanding with Russia, with Putin on this. And again, everything the president does in this regard is transactional. I just fervently believe that certain things are above and beyond the mere transactional. You're dealing with a country that was invaded by Russia without provocation. You're dealing with a country that's a fledgling democracy, not by any means perfect, and we're not perfect after 250 years either.
No.
But Zelensky was elected. Their constitution says they have martial law in the case of war. That's why there's not a subsequent election in Ukraine. Zelensky is not as popular as he was, say, 2 years ago. That's almost to be expected, but it's certainly not at 4%. A polling that I've seen says he's still above 50%, about where President Trump is in the U.S. So I just hope that there are cooler heads in the administration that can kind of get the president off of this cliff that he's put himself on, which I think is a very dangerous one. Regardless of him, it's very dangerous for our country and democracies generally for us to be in this position. So I fervently hope that there may be some things going on that we're not aware of. But frankly, his comments are simply unacceptable and outrageous from my point of view. And I think actually most Republicans believe that as well.
Can I?
Yeah, go ahead.
Just to educate me, because I really am not trying to figure this out. In terms of you meet with Putin first or the Russians first or not, I would have thought that you would meet with your allies and Zelensky and those folks first to get all on the same page. But why do you think it's a better strategy, or it's an okay strategy, that they did the opposite? That's something I've been confused about.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'm just confused.
Well, remember,
I don't disagree.
President Trump met with Zelensky in Paris in December, and there have been emissaries that have met with Zelensky. Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, was meeting with him last week. So,
but you had the allies all together, and it was post this,
yeah,
you know.
I think
John, if I may, that Bessent meeting, though, was an attempted shakedown.
Right.
I mean, that wasn't a how do you see the world? That's, hey, yeah, we want your minerals for what we've already given you.
Yeah, and
that's
and
a
so
whole separate abhorrent thing. Yeah,
I wouldn't necessarily say it's a shakedown, but I would say again, it's his approach. Everything is a transaction. Okay. So
transactional shakedown.
Well, yeah, it's all a shakedown.
But if the concern is that there's not a coherent, and I thought that the allies had come together, but if they weren't, why wouldn't they meet with them first?
I think, frankly, the Europeans are pretty disorganized in terms of their approach on this. There's a lot of fissures. The Germans, for instance, have a very different policy from the UK, which has a different policy from the French. Yeah. And certainly the Poles and the Baltic states and Finland and Sweden are much tougher, as
absolutely
they should be. They're closer to the bear, and the bear is hungry, and the bear wants to eat, gobble up more. Look, Putin.
I don't think he stops at Ukraine, do you?
No,
no,
I don't.
I don't think so at all.
Remember, you know, this guy went into Georgia, right, you know, back in 2011 or 12. He is a voracious. He believes the biggest single catastrophe of the 20th century was the fall of the Soviet Union. He's a former KGB guy,
right,
and he believes that he wants to reconstitute the Russian Empire,
mm-hmm,
as they traditionally have seen it. So that's what's going on here. And I think, frankly, we need to stand four square against that.
Libby? Oh, okay.
Libby?
Wait a minute.
Oh, well, do we need a break?
No, we're good.
Okay. Well, you know,
I bought some time.
Libby just wants to agree with me, so she's priming herself to do
well,
that.
Well, actually, John, I was going to say, surprisingly enough, I agree with most of the things you said. But I do think that that this isn't just transactional. This is Trump wanting to be Putin-esque, wanting to be the dictator of the United States. That someone said recently, I mean, I read it, long live the king. I mean, give me a break. He is not the king. He's never going to be my king, that's for sure, nor will he be the king of the country. I think that Putin may have something on him, but regardless of the fact that the military machinations within Europe are different, there is NATO. And Trump has made it very clear he is abandoning NATO. He doesn't care about that. He wants Putin to do whatever he's going to give Putin the permission to do whatever he wants to do. He's not going to stop. He wants to recreate the motherland. Putin does. There's no two ways about that. And he won't stop at the Ukraine. And I think Trump is willing to write the check and give Putin Ukraine for whatever it is that he gets in return. This man, Trump, is not someone who should have his finger on the lever of the nuclear launch codes or anything else in terms of government. What he is doing to our government and what he is doing to our foreign policy has totally, in just what's it been, 3 weeks?
Days.
Three weeks?
Would you
32
say
30,
days. 32 days?
32 yeah, days. 32 days has
Monday
totally
Tuesday,
has totally undermined the United States' credibility on the world stage. It is undermining our economy. People need to understand. You lay off all those people in Washington, D.C., there's going to be an economic downturn in that city. People are going to have to move. Who's going to buy those houses? Right? There's going to be economic
problems.
Federal
workers are all over the country.
Right. I get that. But still, in Washington, D.C., and in other parts of the country, people, thousands upon thousands of people losing their jobs is going to mean an increase in unemployment insurance that he's not going to want to have to pay, and economic downturn across the country because of this, as well as everything else that he's doing.
I understand that this is all interlocked, but I just want to stay for a moment. Let's just stay with Russia. And
Russia will take over whatever it wants to take over because Trump is not going to put a brake on it.
Teresa was asking questions, but I didn't hear her response yet. But Mark, did you want to?
Sorry, don't let Teresa go.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I appreciate what you said, John. I wonder, and I think, you know, maybe this is for the later conversation, but why your former colleagues, Republican colleagues in the House and the Senate, can't say that same thing. That's deeply, right. deeply troubling.
That was my next question.
I think they started, people started to say this. It's not enough
not
yet,
in
my opinion.
Not in a clear and concise way that you did.
Well, I mean,
and
we're
I
here,
really appreciate
you know,
what you did.
Yeah, and but I think this whole notion of Trump as a Putin toady is really way overstated. Trump gave offensive weapons to Ukraine in 2017 and 18. Trump also argued for the cancellation of the Nord Stream pipeline, which was the main economic lever that the Russians had to control and influence Germany. And that was a very controversial thing. The Germans didn't want him to do it. So he did that. So I think too much of the rhetoric is like, oh, he's a toady. They have something on him. I don't believe that. But I really believe that he sees the great powers. He sees himself as a leader of a great power. He sees Putin as a leader of a great power. And he believes everything's a transaction. I can get in the room. We can make a deal. It's one of his most favorite expressions.
But he's not a good deal maker. I mean, everybody keeps saying that he's a great negotiator. What is the proof of that? I don't mean to say it in that tone, but what is the proof of that?
I'll give you one example, Teresa. He is a bull who walks around with his own china shop, and he said early on that the European countries are not contributing what they should be to NATO, and it's right. They're not spending their own money on their own defense in the level that they need to have a fully functioning NATO. And so the European nations, kicking and screaming, have gradually increased their commitment to NATO.
That was John Faso on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, February 20th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review. On Friday, February 21st, Joe was joined by partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, senior fellow for health policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Bill Hammond, tetherless world professor of computer, web, and cognitive sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler, and vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick.
President of the United States, the chair of the Kennedy Center, and now chair of the United States Postal Service, announced yesterday that he will take control of the Postal Service, firing the Postal Board. This according to a Washington Post exclusive that was published in that newspaper last night. Trump is expected to make the announcement in full today, but is preparing to dissolve the leadership of the Postal Service and absorb the independent mail agency into his administration, potentially throwing the 250-year-old mail provider and trillions of e-commerce transactions into turmoil. Trump is expected to issue an executive order as soon as this week to fire the members of the Postal Service's governing board and place the agency under the control of the Commerce Department and Secretary Howard Lutnick. That according to six people familiar with the plans who spoke on the condition of anonymity out of fear of reprisals. Don't have to worry about that here, do we? Now, The board is planning to fight Trump's order. Three of those people told the Washington Post in an emergency meeting held last night. The board retained outside counsel and gave instructions to sue the White House if the president were to remove members of the board or attempt to alter the agency's independent status. Two of the group's GOP members, Derek Kahn, a former Trump administration official, and Mike Duncan, a former chair of the Republican National Committee, were not in attendance, according to a person familiar with the gathering. The two did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Trump's order to place the Commerce Department in charge of the Postal Service would probably violate federal law, according to postal experts. Another executive order earlier this week instructed independent agencies to align more closely with the White House. We talked about that in yesterday's program. Though that order is likely to prompt court challenges, and the Postal Service, by law, is generally exempt from executive orders. Members of the Postal Service's bipartisan board are appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. Trump, at Lutnick's urging, has mused about privatizing the Postal Service, and Trump's presidential transition team vetted candidates to replace Postmaster General Louis DeJoy. Although I've also heard it Louie. Well, we don't have to worry about him anymore, so I guess we can move on. A retired logistics executive and GOP fundraising official who took office in 2020 during Trump's first term. So that is where we are as of 9:23 on this Friday morning regarding the United States Postal Service. Judy, what do you think?
You know, the status of the post office has been debated for decades. If you ask most Americans, they believe it is a U.S. part of the U.S. government. But then there was this move to separate it from government control. There was a time when postal delivery was so important for every American, especially those in rural areas, to get access to information. It's being used less and less nowadays. I mean, talk about what mail you get every day. It's hard mail. You don't get that much.
Yeah. Well, except for the e-commerce, right? Except for the stuff that you order.
It should be noted that, I mean, Amazon relies on the U.S. Postal Service for a lot of its delivery, and how that will operate going forward is interesting to Jeff Bezos. So there's some political motivations allowed as well. Moving it to the Commerce Department, to me, seems the opposite of privatization. So I'd like to see what happens going forward. Do Americans really care about the Postal Service? I'm not really sure. Do they care about the price of stamps anymore? I'm not so sure. I don't even know what the price of a first-class stamp costs.
Well, no,
right now.
Because it's called forever. I mean, you don't know. It's not a 10-cent stamp or a 22-cent stamp. It's a forever stamp, and they change it, and you have no idea what it is. It's like when they started doing Easy Pass on the freeway. You didn't know what the tolls were anymore.
So I just want to point out that when we talk about the Postal Service, right, there's this document which has Article 1, Section 8, Clause 7. It's called the U.S. Constitution, which gives Congress the power to essentially establish post office, post routes, control the land for the post roads, build buildings necessary, define routes, et cetera, et cetera. So we're not only talking about something where Trump is trying to make a play to move something into the executive branch that by the Constitution belongs to the congressional branch. So there's been a lot of arguments about how to run it and stuff. The creation of the Postal Board was essentially a compromise that said, okay, we'll make it an independent congressional entity, thus fulfilling the Constitution, but giving, you know, Senate approval, right, lets it stay with us, even though the president's making nominations, and similar things happen for a lot of other organizations. This one, though, is not something where somebody arbitrarily passed a law at some random time in the past 100 years that Trump is throwing out, which there have been a lot of. This is one that literally goes back to the United States Constitution, which I vaguely remember that about 33 days ago, somebody put his hand on the Bible and said, you know,
I promised to uphold that thing.
Actually, he did not.
Somebody promised as much as he makes any promises. But yes.
You know, I agree that, you know, the post office seems a little dated, and we all question, you know, the role it has in our day-to-day life now. But there is, you know, in my immigration brain, there are some aspects of the post office that serve an important purpose. For example, that's the one access point for a lot of people to get passports. That's the passport, you know, that's where you go to get your take your picture, and they submit everything to Department of State for processing. So they serve important functions, and they're everywhere, right? In rural communities, urban communities. And so it makes it accessible to everybody. Without them doing this service, how would people go? You would have to go to a passport agency, which is mostly in like urban centers in along the East Coast or the West Coast. And then also you think about mail-in ballots. You know, everyone has used to seeing the box. And so what does it look like for you to be submitting your vote for president and they control the agency that you're submitting your vote? Like, it just seems like it needs to be an independent agency. And so it's very concerning, actually. I know we don't get much mail. I look at it maybe once a week. I think it's my daughter's job to check the mailbox now because I just can't. But but I think it serves other functions that are so important. And maybe for us who live in these, you know, near these city centers, it doesn't seem as important. But for other people where they rely on it, for someone that uses FedEx, for example, and UPS frequently, we see how much the surcharge is to deliver to certain areas of the world and certain areas of the country. And so I can only imagine how it would affect individuals who don't have as much access to getting mail and things and packages and things like that.
I mean, the fact that, so as of July of last year, the price of a stamp is 73 cents.
Oof.
So, okay, you say woo, but you're going to take a letter and put it into a box in Albany, New York, and have it sent to Chicago.
Sitka, Alaska.
Or Alaska in 2 to 3 days, and it's going to cost you 73 cents. That's still not bad.
I have to say, I didn't have this on my bingo card that Trump would pick a fight over the post office. But reading, it was an occasion to learn a little bit of history, that in 1970... under the Nixon administration, there was a bipartisan agreement to reorganize the post office. It was kind of semi-privatizing it.
Yes.
But the problem back then was there was too much mail. Like they were overwhelmed with the volume because we hadn't invented email yet. And this
right.
was the only...
And now we're overwhelmed with that.
Well, it seems like rethinking the operation in the light of 54 years of change makes a certain amount of sense. The thing is, there's like everything the Trump administration is doing is shoot first, ask questions later. Like there's no laying the groundwork for
no.
This is why we're doing what we're doing. There's no thinking process. It's just boom. And yeah.
We're talking about the United States Postal Service, and President Trump is expected to take control of the Postal Service. I do think there's an interesting the wording that we're using here is interesting in that we saw this with the Postal Service and we see this with the Kennedy Center, that it is not that the federal government is taking it over. It is not that this department is taking it over. It is that Trump is expected to take control of the United States Postal Service the same way as he will be chair of the Kennedy Center. And that, I think, is it just gives us a sense as to, I can't make any sense of it, so I don't really know what it gives us sense to.
It is indeed the 40,000 mile view, isn't it?
Yes.
About what is happening in so many segments of our society. You know, and it's interesting because I don't know how he has the energy for it. You know, unless there was a document, for example, that laid this all out, and he just is saying it's go time, and there are so many things. It just must be a great time to be a lawyer in Washington.
Power revs you up, though, right?
I guess. I don't know. I've never had it, so.
You know, when you're like playing Risk or Stratego, you're like, all right, I'm going after the Postal Service.
I mean, constitutional law, like you're saying, constitutional law professors are like just, you know, licking their chops. I feel so bad for these law school students because the hypotheticals that are coming down the chain are, you know, it's like whiplash. Because we've never had to reference, like, you know, Jim was saying earlier, the Constitution so often, you know, it's only been, what, 4 or 5 weeks? I mean, it's really basics. It's like the government basics. What can they do? What can't they do? What aren't they doing? And, you know, something as that you just took for granted, such as, you know, him becoming board of Kennedy Center. And you're just like, what? Wait, what? Paper straws, right? Like, right. You're just like, you're reading all these executive orders and
wow,
you don't know.
I didn't know I had that.
I didn't know we could. You could do this.
And, changing the name of the Gulf of Mexico.
Yes.
Wow. You know, like
stopping congestion pricing in New York City.
Well, that's right. Now, my, you know, interesting you say this, but my my nephew is a second year law student, and I was talking to him 3 nights ago, and he said he had a professor say in class, he goes, you know, I feel like we have to start from scratch. Like, I know you're a year and a half into this, but
everything's out the window.
Right. You know, we're trying to catch up. But
I mean, it's taking all the way back to Marbury v. Madison.
Yeah, it's the very beginning. Really fascinating. Gail says, wait a minute, people. Some of us need the Postal Service for paying bills, internet, yes, not reliable, receiving payments, not to mention ballots, actual letters. Can anyone spell rural? Joe is right. Getting a letter from the West Coast or Ireland or Tanzania is a gift. Other things are necessities. This may be the demonstration I'm waiting for. Thank you, as always.
Well, point of information, I think I just got a notice that Tanzania is on the list of places that you cannot receive mail. I believe so. But there's a list of places where you can't, the U.S. Postal Service is not receiving or sending mail right now. I mean, it came out, it's important to us in immigration because we have to know whether or not people in these countries can receive notices and things like that. But this is the small things that are happening in the background with the U.S. Postal Service.
Well, and let's take some other little things, right? I mean, how do you think most people get their Social Security payments every month? The Social Security administration is not doing that online unless you specifically request it to your bank, which is non-trivial to arrange if you don't know what you're doing. If you're living in a rural community which doesn't have good internet, your primary internet connection is your phone, and you're reliant on Social Security, getting rid of the post office is a lifeline. I mean, you know, people don't seem to think through these things to the depths of which, yeah, boy, I'll be upset that I don't get such and such a catalog.
But a lot of those small post offices have been closed over the years. I mean, years ago, I did a story where I drove around into the hollows of Schoharie County and visited all these tiny little post offices. A lot of them have closed just because of economic necessity. So you are seeing a closing, and then you're seeing shortening of hours. Anyway, there's still one in my town, but I've seen the other ones close. I mean, it used to be that being named postmaster was a political job.
Yes.
And it was a very important thing to establish support at the local electoral level. That has no longer been the case.
Well, you bring up a good point. I mean, but it's different than, so Judy and I live in the same town. So within 3 miles, there is the Greenwich Post Office, the Middle Falls Post Office, and the Schuylerville Post
I think there
office.
Used to be a Casiuna Post Office.
There is still a Casiuna Post Office. So the point being that, like, if you were talking about, we want to look and see if we can move in some of these, change these codes, bring these areas together, that's different, right? And then just we're going to take this over. And then what? We don't know the second part of that sentence right now.
I mean, we don't know. I mean, they're going to he's talked about it. He's going to privatize it, and then he's going to give it a contract to someone who wants it. And someone's going to run it. It's going to be like a for-profit business.
That was Sienna Freeman-Tolbert on the Roundtable panel on Friday, February 21st. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.